I won't say forever, because you never know in this work, but at least for the foreseeable future. We thought we'd be back in a year to continue doing what we were doing on the Gold Coast. Early heads. But that's the way it went. Our children are grown up now, as obviously some of yours are. Becky is a junior in Ambassador College, aged 20, something like that. And Judy is a freshman in Ambassador College, and aged 18 or something like that. Both of them are thoroughly American and have not forgotten where they were born. In fact, they would desperately like to come back. They still love Vegemite, and we still have a big jar of Vegemite in our food cupboard at home. I don't know how old it is, but it doesn't seem to make any difference. And occasionally we use it to give to homesick Australians when they come over. I'm one of my hats at Pasadena is to be the international student coordinator in helping the various strange and exotic students who come in. And of course, Aussies, after the initial flash of excitement, find themselves getting a bit homesick. It's surprising what a Vegemite sandwich and or a Minty will do to them. And so we keep a large supply of Vegemite on hand. You can buy it in America, but no one takes it seriously. You get it from a spare parts auto store. Hasn't been passed as food, but you know, it's a... And Australian beers are becoming very popular over there too. Currently, I am working with the World Tomorrow program, among other things, at the college. Frankly, in 1977, when we left, we walked into a period of turmoil in the work in America, which is kind of ironic because, as some of the old-timers remember here, Mr. Lewak and others, we went through a period of mini-turmoil here in the early 70s and mid-70s, right in the Sydney church, with a lot of people who perhaps were not as loyal to what we thought they believed as they should have been, and quite a lot of trials and problems surrounding what is now apparently a chemical factory in Artarmon. I went down there the other day, and it's completely changed. It's full of chemicals now. It used to be our press. Walked round the back, and I could almost see Mr. Lewak ready to serve me gas. But he's gone. He's been replaced by a large metal drum. Things change, but I work with the World Tomorrow program. I began to work in television about 1981 by a strange set of circumstances. I had absolutely no training in it and knew nothing about it. Now, I still don't think I know very much about it, but at least I know enough to help get the program out. And of course, when Mr. Armstrong died, the World Tomorrow program became an entirely new ball game, as they say over there. And we've all had to work pretty hard for a couple of years. Yesterday we were doing some taping down by the Harbour Bridge. We're going to do a program on the bicentenary of Australia next year. And since Alligator Albert was here, we thought we would do a section with him against the Harbour Bridge. Went very well, and got all that done, and you'll see that probably about March of this year, which we hope we can say something that'll be a bit more meaningful to Aussies, done on their home turf. Got the Opera House and the background and the Harbour Bridge, and we hired a television crew from Australia, which was a delight to work with, except that I had to learn the language all over again. Ah, just a minute, John. Get us another couple of battos, Trevor, will you? Like, what are battos? I wrote to his batteries for his camera. And so I have to sort of wind back and say, what's all this all about? But it worked very, very well. And I hope we can make a good job of that program. It's one we can really put our heart into. Dr. Albert, Dave Albert, loved Australia. He's been raving about it ever since I ran into him last Thursday, and saying what a wonderful place it is and how much he'd like to be here and so on, how much he enjoyed all of you and how much you enjoyed all of him. And he's really got his heart into making a really good program for Australia, which is great. And Mr. Fay was there, and he was very enthusiastic about it too. So I think we're going to have a good program. I can certainly put my heart into it because, in a way, Australia is home for my wife and myself in a way that nowhere else is. Because I'm British and she's American. But we really began our work together and living, not living together, we were married, you know. In Melbourne for 5 years, and then up here for 3 years, and then up in Queensland for 2 years. And Australia was as much home as anywhere else is for us. And it was funny driving around Sydney yesterday and going and looking at the old place we used to live at in Blarney Avenue, Killarney Heights, which has now got a swimming pool in the front garden, never when I was there. And then over in Pennant Hills, where we moved when the office moved out, and going and seeing those homes gave a funny feeling, like we'd never been away in some ways. And started to feel kind of nostalgic. I could have been an Aussie. My great-great-grandfather was a Solicitor General of New South Wales way back in 1842. One of the few who came because he wanted to in those days. And our family went back to England in 1912. So I'm a sort of a reverse migrant, but at least one quarter of me is truly Australian. I always felt very, very much at home here, and even picking up some of the language again, listening to Mr. Villiers read verses from the Gospel and interpreting in his own particular way. I don't mean inaccurately, I mean with saying, "It's not on, Jesus." It's great to hear that again, and very quickly we'll drop all these American expressions like ball game and see what we can do. Don't be surprised if some of it slips in. World Tomorrow program, of course, has changed tremendously, and it's very exciting to work with. Whenever Australians come through Pasadena, they try and look us up in the studio. I'm always very happy to see them. Then they want to say, "Oh, do you think we could see the program being made?" And I always say no. Usually, basically, I always ask the question, "Do you like sausages?" And they say yes, or they say yeah. I say, "Well, the World Tomorrow program, or people who like the World Tomorrow program, are kind of like people who like sausages. Don't be there when they're being made, and you'll continue to enjoy them." Because making a television program isn't the smooth, simple, sequential operation that you think it is. And I think Mr. Fay learned a lot yesterday, apart from nearly falling in Sydney Harbour. We gave him something to do, and he was standing right on the edge of the water, and one step other way and he'd have gone in, which would have made great television, but unfortunately didn't happen. Australia's changed a lot in 10 years in some ways. It has in another ways. The traffic's just as bad. The beer's just as good. But I have noticed a difference in feeling, a difference in flavor. You know, really, the first time I ever came into this hall was in July. No, it wasn't. It was in early June 1967. And I remember, and some of you can probably remember that, except you'd have no reason to. Coming in here on the first morning, we just arrived from America, my wife and I, and our eldest daughter, in a sense, had arrived as well. And she hadn't arrived yet, if you see what I mean, but it wasn't long. And she rested up, my wife rested up over in the Twin Towers Hotel in Ataman, and I came on here to services, thoroughly jet-lagged, but I didn't have enough sense to realize it then, and sat down over there, and I believe it was Mr. Cole was talking, and I listened, or half-listened, and dozed through the sermon, like many of you at the time. I never thought, in my wildest of dreams, that I would be in Ryde Town Hall in 1987. Mainly because I didn't believe then that Ryde Town Hall would be here in 1987, let alone me. And back then, we all thoroughly expected that, you know, that Christ would come in 1975. Well, we didn't really believe that, but we all acted as if we did, like hoping our teeth would last and everything else, remember? And, you know, never dreamed that there'd be an Australia where Dennis Lilly had retired, where Greg Chappell was no longer the captain of the team, and so on. Never dreamed of an Australia would be having its bicentenary. I never dreamed in wildest of imaginations that Mr. Hawke would be the Prime Minister of Australia. And I don't think he did then either. He was just become the president of the ACTU at the time. And looking back, 20 years is such a long time. Looking back also over 20 years, and if you'll pardon me getting nostalgic, I'm too young to get maudlin, but I'm not too young to get nostalgic. I can't sit and say, when I was a young man, because I still think I am. My children would take great exception to that remark. They're thoroughly convinced that anyone under the age of 22 is past it. But you can look back over a series of experiences and learn something from them. And looking back, you can, especially when you can sort of look back on events, you can almost recreate how you thought back then. Now, this hall has got a lot of memories for me. It's got a lot of good memories. It's got a lot of awkward memories. Got a lot of memories, like when Mr. Luca wasn't terribly satisfied with some aspect of my performance, but I can't imagine why. And by the way, he sends his greetings. We saw him not long ago, and Dennis and Leanne Luca send their greetings down to you. But at the time, he wasn't about to send his greetings to me. And he threatened he was going to pull me out, and I repented in time, and he left us here. But at the time, there were circumstances that were going on that were leaving people sort of tense, and some of the old timers remember that. The period around the move to Burley Heads was a rather tense time, and some things seemed so very, very important at the time. They had to be resolved. They needed to be done. Looking back, you can see where A, God took care of it, and B, it wasn't as critical as all that. But also, looking back, you can say, if some of us hadn't been what we were then, it could have gone in another direction. And what I'm talking about is willing to stand faithful for what we believed, but at the same time to be willing to respond to church government and the belief in the church being what it was, and so on, suffering a certain amount of tension, but it worked out all right. Looking back, you can learn some lessons, some experience. One of the things that I learned through that experience, which was to be very helpful in some perhaps even more traumatic situations in Pasadena that went on, was that when you stop and think about it, yes, you can worry. Perhaps sometimes you should share the concerns and problems and difficulties, but in the long run, it works out all right. It was important, but it wasn't the massive obstacle that it seemed to have been at the time. It was something the church was going through and needed to have been done. We've got to be willing to take the changes in direction, the alterations in what God is expecting from us at any one time. You see, right back then, we were planning campaigns in Sydney. Some of you remember that. And we were planning because we thought we were running out of time. And we thought it was important. And I remember taking it was Mr. Ted Armstrong was planning to come down here at the time, and we were planning a massive campaign there. Now, looking back on it, that would have been a bit premature. I remember we had a campaign out at Blacktown, and only a few people came, and I was very worried and thinking, well, so on. Now, some of those people may have eventually become members of the church. That it seems big at the time, it seems important at the time. Looking back, it wasn't so important, but it doesn't make it unimportant. It's important that you and I are responding to what God wants done at any one time in His church. very important that we are responsive to what God is wanting us to go through. Now again, let me speak not from maudlin experience, but from a certain amount of reminiscence and bring to mind some things we can, many of us can share and perhaps haven't thought about. That the lessons you learnt in the circumstances that some of us went through, sometimes trying circumstances, agonizing circumstances, worrying circumstances, equipped us to help other people downstream when similar things happened to them. God taught us some lessons and allowed some circumstances that were not the best to build in us experience, faith, balance, understanding, comprehension, and so on. Looking back, I wouldn't have missed any of that for anything, because it helped. By the same token, we need to be aware and understanding of what God wants done in His church today, because who knows how long we have to go? I really don't know. I think we're wising up and not setting dates. I don't think it's very long. How long is a very? Not telling you. There's two reasons I'm not telling you. First of all, you will quote me, and secondly, I don't know. The first isn't always dependent on the second, where people are concerned. But I don't know how long we have. I don't think it's very long. We've never thought it was very long. But the point is, God knows how long it is. He knows what He's doing, and He knows what He's building in us as the years go by. And you and I are on a course that God is putting us through to teach us some things so that when the time comes, we're ready to do the most important job of all. Mr. Dukach is coming here in December, January, somewhere there. He's going to be saying a few things to you. It'll be wonderful to see him. I've had the privilege of working fairly closely with Mr. Dukach in his first 2 years, working with him, following him with the television cameras, helping him in preparing for the trips and helping the team working with him. And I've come to see that Mr. Dukach is exactly what God's church needed next. Exactly what God's church needed next. And that gives you a certain amount of confidence. Mr. Dukach has been telling us some things in the past year or so, all of us. You know, God puts in the church first apostles. And then it says, Ephesians, wherever it is. Same Bible down here said it begins with Revelation. Yep. See, the same man who laughs at my jokes is still in the church. That's wonderful. Appreciate that. But in Ephesians it talks about God puts in the church first apostles and then the other ranks of the ministry. Why? For the edification of everybody, for the teaching of everybody, so that we all, everybody, apostles, pastors, teachers, elders, the works, and all the members, all come to the point where Jesus Christ wants us to be. And He works through the level of government, from apostle, down through us, till we all understand what we need to understand. Mr. Dukach has been saying in recent weeks, that he's concerned that we are becoming very, very effective at throwing our hearts into doing the work. But he's concerned, and that means that Jesus Christ is concerned, that we become so effective and diligent at doing the work, but we may be overlooking the spiritual growth and developing the family relationships and the interpersonal relationships and so on that we also must do. And he made an interesting statement in a recent Worldwide News where he said that, you know, God will not let us continue to have great physical growth and success in spreading the gospel if it's not accompanied with an appropriate amount of spiritual growth, and so the church is becoming stronger and stronger and stronger, as well as more effective. That should get us all thinking. It certainly seemed to be a theme in the feast, and I assume it was a theme in the feast here. He pointed out that God could use other means to preach the first commission. When I was the pastor of Sydney, I would, and then later on Mr. Luker asked me to organize campaigns throughout all Australia, I put my heart into it, and I did it as if it all depended on me. Well, thankfully it didn't, because the workers managed to struggle on somehow after I'd gone, quite effectively. And yet, on the other hand, it's important when you're doing something to put your heart into it. But God could use other means. He wouldn't even have to have World Tomorrow programs, plain truths, campaigns, whatever as we have down here. He's quite capable of getting a message out to the world by other means. His words use the example of Balaam's ass or stones. But in order to give us an environment, a project, if you like, to work on together, and you really learn things by working on a project, he has given the project of getting the gospel out to the people he's training for the world tomorrow. But it's important that we remember that he's training us with this project to work with him in the world tomorrow. And the most important job that we've got to do, Mr. Dukacz has been pointing out, is to not qualify, that's not the word to use, but be ready to serve with Jesus Christ, doing what God wants to do next in the world tomorrow. Because although he could do the first commission, as we've called it, without us, he does need us. He can't do the second part of the job without us. He can't serve humanity in the world tomorrow without the people that Jesus Christ has worked with in this age to get ready for that assignment. So it's vital that we don't, in our enthusiasm to do the work, lose or not make progress with growing spiritually. I have learned in the last 10 years to have a great deal of respect for what God does through the mind of a man who we will call an apostle, the rank of apostle, the leading minister in the church. And when Mr. Dukacz succeeded Mr. Armstrong, it was logical that he became an apostle. He was discussing that once with us, I remember. And he said, I wonder whether I should call myself, or at least not call myself, I wonder whether I am an apostle. I said, Mr. Dukacz, if you're not, what are you, a five-star evangelist? The leading minister, the head minister, the one who is over the ministry and over the brethren and over the chief executive officer, if you like, of the church, according to the Bible, is an apostle. And certainly none of us, I presume, have any difficulty with that. But the rank of apostle, the office of apostle, God works with in an unusual way. And it's good and important to think about what he's telling us, because you'll find out what is important to Jesus Christ at any one stage. When we went into Pasadena in 1977, actually it was the last week of 1977, we arrived just after Christmas, I was really surprised. Mr. Graham Marshall and I went in together. And we went in for what they call the sabbatical program. But I hadn't been there very long before I realized that things were not right in the work at Pasadena. And we felt very uncomfortable. First of all, we were taught some strange things. Mr. Marshall and I, who I think we're both reasonably conservative people and certainly had tried to be faithful to Mr. Herbert Armstrong, and also, by the way, to Mr. Dean Wilson, sends his greetings to you all. Love to see you all again. And when I was sat in a classroom and was taught by men who were supposed to be evangelists and pastors and taught things that I thought, this isn't true, or if it's true, Mr. Armstrong is wrong. When we sat in a business class in Ambassador College and the instructor used Mr. Armstrong as an example of bad management, I think to myself, this isn't the Ambassador College that I grew up in. I mean, you'd be zapped from heaven on the spot for even thinking it back then. And here's this guy talking about Mr. Armstrong made this mistake and this mistake. And then you'd sit around and people would say, well, unless we get rid of the Armstrongs, we're never going to get ahead. Things like that. Statements were believed about, we need to go back and rethink everything, starting from scratch. And you began to feel very, very uncomfortable. First of all, you thought, well, I must be misunderstanding this. I'm dumber than I thought. I'm just not really. And people would say, you need to get with it. You need to get with a new feeling. You need to get with a new flow. And I thought, hey, get me back to Australia quick, where they're just behind times. Get me back where, you know, people sort of believe the Sabbath should be kept. People should tithe. Oh, no. And it all began to be reminiscent of some things we struggled with here even earlier. And, you know, you thought, well, something's wrong. And, of course, it all blew up later that year, and Jesus Christ moved into his church pretty fast, cleaned things out, and essentially restored control and sanity and a proper, sane government into his church. And we could all breathe a sigh of relief. What I didn't realize at the time was that I would be able to be a part of the restoration of Ambassador College to a college where you can train young people in God's ways. And I was very grateful for those opportunities to help. And it was Mr. Armstrong's decision that we didn't come back to Australia. I was looking forward to coming back to Australia and working with Asia. It was his, well, I want to keep us at Pasadena, which is a fine. But you know, Mr. Armstrong nearly died back in those days. Boy, would we have been in a mess if he had been. The respect for the truth among certain leading ministers, or we thought they were leading ministers, had almost gone. And so many of the fundamental things that now are sort of a part of our thinking would have been lost if Jesus Christ had allowed Mr. Armstrong to die back when he had that series of heart attacks and did literally stop breathing for a period of time. God did not allow him to die. He brought him back. And we had the opportunity to work fairly closely with him in the last 8 years of his life. Now, in that time, I've never seen anybody try harder or work harder against some quite difficult handicaps. I know we always like to think of Mr. Armstrong as being Superman, you know, sort of underwear on the outside and a red cape leaping to your buildings at a branch, you know. Well, he was an old man who had a desperate urgency about him to accomplish something. Now, for a while, I don't think I fully understood what was going on. Didn't fully understand that Mr. Armstrong was working against time to establish something in the church, that God gave him another 9 years of life, not just for his own favor, because frankly, the old man would rather, I think, have rested. He was old, he was tired. I watched him very intimately as he struggled to make television programs, and how he'd make half of one and then said, oh, I can't do this anymore, I can't see, what am I going to do, and so on. And then go back to it, how he'd struggle with his writing and his reading. And you begin to think, why doesn't God let the old man rest? It seemed fairly evident to you when you watch world news that the kingdom wasn't going to come in his lifetime, the way he was failing physically, and yet world events were not speeding up, unless there was going to be a dramatic fulfillment of prophecy all of a sudden, or Mr. Armstrong was going to be dramatically healed, Mr. Armstrong was going to die. But at the same time, he didn't die, and he kept working and working and working. Now, I don't know, Henry, did he ever come down to Australia in those last few years? Maybe he came once or twice. You heard him speak. You heard him speak about what? The two trees. Remember the two trees? They're big now. When he started, they were just little tiny trees. They were pot plants. But he watered them and he watered them and he watered them until by the time he died, everybody on the church could see those two trees. Till we were sick of them. Right? Kind of like Moses. Every time Moses got up to speak, Now, you remember how I told you about how God led us through the terrible wilderness in the Red Sea, and you can think of the Israelites saying, "Oh, not the Red Sea, Moses. Please, Moses, not this week. It was last week, and it was Bible study, and it was spokesman's club, and you can't..." The Red Sea, Moses, wasn't it? And remember that? And you wouldn't do this? And you disobeyed and so on. You remember how God took you through the wilderness? We don't. We know. Yeah, right. All through the book of Deuteronomy, every time he got up, was the Red Sea and the wilderness. Can't he talk about anything else? The answer was no. Moses had burned into his mind that these people needed to learn the lesson of the Red Sea. But they didn't learn it. And consequently, they made the mistake of not knowing it. The lesson of the Red Sea, the lesson of how God could protect them, the lesson of Sinai, the lesson of being an important people who must faithfully and loyally follow the commandments of God and be a model nation, in spite of all that they had experienced, didn't sink in. And the children of Israel didn't get what Moses was trying to say. It just went over their heads. You know, apostles can be a bit of a disappointment sometimes, can't they? Like John. "A new commandment I give you." "Oh yeah? Great, what is it? We can eat pork? Christmas is all right?" And what was the new commandment? So you can see that early church sort of, "Hey, new commandment coming up. Hey, wake up. What is it?" "That you love one another." "Oh, come on. Come off the grass, John. That's not a new commandment. Everybody knows that. That's all you ever talk about. One gospel, one full-length epistle, and two pages. All about love. That's not new. Do you ever talk about anything else?" That's what that man had to get into the church. It's important that you understand what Jesus meant by love. Because times are coming and you're going to forget that. And if you forget that, things are going to start happening and they're going to fall apart. And so that old apostle kept ramming things into those people's minds. You've got to love one another. If you think you love God and you don't love your brother, forget it. No way. It's not on. And they must have thought, here he goes again. Who's speaking this week? Oh, we got a guest from Jerusalem. Or Patmos. Who is it? It's John. Oh, yeah. What's he going to talk about? Love, probably. All right. So, Mr. Armstrong will get up at commencement in Pasadena. And we think, well, at least he can't talk about the two trees. Forget he did. He did. You come into the TV studio. "Well, fellas, I think I'd better make a Christmas program." "Okay. Once upon a time, there were two trees." You think, oh, come on. Am I the only one who got a little bit tired about hearing about the two trees? I don't think so. Well, one day, not long before he died, I had the opportunity to have lunch with Mr. Armstrong. You tend to remember the times you spent sort of more intimately with Mr. Armstrong because they were rare. And as he got older, he found it hard to be in a crowd of people because the hearing wasn't as acute as it used to be. And of course, his eyesight had always been a problem. But towards the end of his life, I was gratified that I was one of the people that he recognized by sight, and he knew me as being reasonably reliable. I think he thought I was slightly insane. But I remember Mrs. Myrtle Horn told me once, "So, well, Mr. Armstrong likes your speaking," which of course makes you feel 10 meters high all of a sudden. Was it feet? Are you still on feet? No, you're on kilometers now, aren't you? Boy, Hornsby was further away than I thought. It was 12 kilometers. All European. What next? You sell beer by the liter now, I suppose, too, don't you? How many liters in a stubby? Anyway. Or a schooner.
Do they have schooners anymore, or is it litres now, or what? Gas. My great-great-grandfather would never have allowed it. Anyway, so anyway, Mr. Armstrong recognized me by sight, and I spent a few times with him. One of the times, he was having lunch in his house, and he'd asked me to come over to discuss something about television. And of course, I came over right away, and Aaron Dean was there, and Mr. Armstrong said, sit down, have some lunch. Well, I'd had lunch, but you didn't tell him that. He said, okay, I'll have more lunch, you know. So he asked me what he wanted to ask about television. It was something about, I forget the details. Then he said, well, I thought he meant get back to work. He said, you know, I've been thinking about something I've never thought of before. Yeah? Hey, great, I'm the first to hear it. This is fantastic. And he said, you know, going back to the Garden of Eden, and something on my face must have registered. Because he could see better than we thought he could when he wanted to. And he looked at me and he said, don't you want to hear it? Oh, yes, Mr. Armstrong. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, Garden of Eden. What? You know. And he said, you're tired of hearing about the two trees, aren't you? Me too? No, Mr. Armstrong. Hey, listen, give me the twigs, give me the buds. Mr. Armstrong, I never hear. You can't lie, can you? I said, well, sir, I've heard you talk about it before. And he said, well, you know why I talk about it all the time? Now, the answer to that question is not because you haven't got anything else to talk about. And I said, why? He said, because people still don't get it. That was an indirect attack, so I didn't have to retaliate. And he looked at me and he said, you don't get it. There was no help in sight. So I said, well, Mr. Armstrong, with respect, sir, I really think I do. He said, well, you don't use it. You never use it in your articles. Didn't even know he knew I wrote articles. I've never heard you mention it. The answer to that is not, well, that's because you would do it all the time and we didn't. Because, sort of, yeah. He said, I'm going to keep on talking about this and people get it. And we finished our meal. He talked about the two trees. And I left. But it got me thinking. Did I get it? Was it a part of my thinking? Oh, I knew it. Someone gave me Genesis. I could explain it. In fact, I probably would go over it rather superficially, because he does it all the time. Begin to think about it. Maybe I didn't get it. Why keep an old, tired man alive, working, pushing, struggling? God's a God of mercy and compassion. Mr. Armstrong's body was giving up on him. He had so many physical problems. Life wasn't as pleasant and as comfortable for him in the last 2 or 3 years of his life, and particularly the last year of his life. It was just a tremendously courageous, dogged effort. And at a time when I think all of us would have understood, if God had allowed his old apostle to die or even retire, but you didn't mention that around Mr. Armstrong. I didn't use the word retire. Otherwise, you were. What was going on? What was being done? I began to realize that perhaps my understanding of the office of apostle, of church government, and of what an apostle is for was a little superficial. It wasn't simply to provide a focal point for the church and so on. That when Mr. Armstrong had written those headlines back in the awful days right after the receivership, they must have seemed worse to us than they did to you, about Christ reestablishes his truth in his church, I began to realize how close we had come to losing it. And when Mr. Armstrong was struggling to finish Mystery of the Ages, before he died. He just made it before he died. In fact, his last public appearance, pretty well, certainly the last time we ever televised him, was when he handed out his book, I think symbolically and importantly. The last time I ever saw Mr. Armstrong alive, he handed out his book to the students of Ambassador College. You remember the film we made of that? And he passed it out to them. He was passing on the truth. He could do no more. He'd worked, he'd researched, he'd studied it for over 50 years, well over 50 years, maybe 60 years, maybe longer than that. No, just under 60 years. Now he was passing it on. And 2 months later, he was dead. But the two trees was something we didn't get. It was something that we needed to understand, because that incident provided a foundation for understanding the truth. Without an understanding that this world was built on a wrong foundation, that this world was deceived by Satan, and that mankind chose to cut himself off from the knowledge of God and consequently built a civilization that is not built on the true understanding of God, if you don't understand that, the church has difficulty becoming anything else but a fundamental evangelical Protestant sect. Think about it. When you understand that the world is built on a wrong foundation, that it includes its government, its religion, its sports, its everything, you provide a basis, you provide a foundation, if you please, for re-education. Mr. Armstrong's job as an apostle was to restore the truth. And back in 1977, Jesus Christ must have realized he hasn't done it, because the men who would have taken over this work and its logical rulers, the natural successors to Mr. Armstrong, didn't understand. I won't say they didn't believe. I don't mean they were evil men. I don't say they were bad men. I will say their vanity and disappointment and personal ambition got the better of them. And consequently, although we'd love to see some of them back with us, they decided they couldn't walk with us anymore. We have no personal animosity towards those who left, but one must admit that they would have led us sadly astray, as they were doing, because we sat in the classes where they taught and we listened. Bob Fay and I, Bob was in for 6 months of the time I was in there, behaving rather like an eagle in a cage. And he couldn't stand it either, because the truth wasn't being taught. And it's not so much that error was being taught, but when the truth isn't taught, error comes in, because there's no foundation. You can't say, well, this doesn't belong. Where does the foundation start? This might belong. Let's discuss this idea. I remember people in classes saying, now this may not be right, but this is an interesting idea. Later on you realize it was a bunch of codswallop. Wrong, because it belonged to the knowledge and understanding of this world. What Mr. Armstrong had to do before he died was to make sure, or should we say what Jesus Christ had to do, was to make sure that the people who would succeed Mr. Armstrong understood what had been restored to the church and used that as a foundation. That's what that old apostle's job was to do. When that was done to Jesus Christ's satisfaction, and I can assure you now that the men who succeeded Mr. Armstrong, primarily Mr. Joseph Tkach, who incidentally fasted every day, once a week for a year. Before he died, Mr. Tkach has told us that Mr. Armstrong told him, Mr. Tkach, I think your main job will be to weld God's church into a family. Mr. Armstrong left the foundation. He said, I don't know what your responsibilities will be, from the point of view of the World Tomorrow program, Mr. Armstrong had the gravest of difficulty seeing anybody do the World Tomorrow program except him. He tried us all out. I think that would have been the biggest get well card he could possibly have had. It was hilarious. I mean, I hope those tapes stay for posterity, because we all tried. And in the end, he said, well, maybe it just better run my tapes till Christ comes, you know, because one of Mr. Descartes' first duties was to appoint three men to make the World Tomorrow program. It's interesting that Mr. Descartes chose three men who together, I think, continued the tradition without being spectacular personalities in their own right, which would be the wrong thing now, what with the religious scandals in the United States. The last thing we want is a glittering, plastered down personality who's got a wife with an air conditioned doghouse. And I can assure you that Mrs. Ames, Mrs. Albert, and Mrs. Hume do not have air conditioned doghouse. In fact, I don't even think they've got dogs. So rest assured that the work is going to go on. But it seems to me that Mr. Albert reflects that intellectual depth that Mr. Armstrong used to bring in on philosophical questions. Mr. Hume has a grasp of world news situations, and that Mr. Ames reflects very well the doctrinal ability to explain that Mr. Armstrong had. Mr. Armstrong's kind of been replaced on the program by three different men, but all having a very strong belief and trust and desire to preach the truth. The first thing we did when Mr. Armstrong died, Mr. Partian called me at 6 o'clock in the morning. First thing I did was to start writing the obituary, something you didn't dare do before Mr. Armstrong died. If he'd found out that we were writing his obituary, our own would have preceded it. And then the television stations told us, well, you've got 1 week to get a new man on or you're through. We can't have a dead man speaking. So it was a bit of a rush. And televisions had a hard couple of years, but there's some heroes there working behind the scenes, people who you don't necessarily know but have worked tremendously hard in the last few years to keep the program on the air. And I think we've not only demonstrated that it under Mr. Descartes' apostleship is to keep the program on the air, and I think we've not only demonstrated that it under Mr. Descartes' apostleship the World Tomorrow program could continue, but also that it should continue, and that there's still a job to do. I think we're going to see these things, the plain truth, the World Tomorrow, the other things, continuing to do their job and continuing to grow. The income has not fallen. God has indicated that when Mr. Armstrong died, the work had to go on, but there were also some things to learn along the way. Mr. Descartes told us that he was going to build on Mr. Armstrong's foundation, and he tried to do that. But also, he said, I am not Mr. Armstrong. If God had wanted Mr. Armstrong to continue, he could have kept him alive. So Mr. Descartes, as he's begun to take hold and grip the job, has put his own particular personality into the work. Now, a church or a work cannot be built around the personality of a leader, but it can be reinforced by it. Maybe a mistake that many of us made with Mr. Armstrong was to put him as the central personality when we thought church instead of Jesus Christ. He never wanted that. Mr. Descartes doesn't want that. But that is not to diminish the role of personality. Personality is a very important factor in what a person does and the direction their life takes. Each of you have got your own personality. You hopefully are developing the character of Jesus Christ. You read the prophets, you see that Jeremiah had a certain personality. Isaiah had a certain personality. Joshua did. The Apostle Paul did. The Apostle Paul had a very different personality to Barnabas, to the point where they had a conflict. So, although a church cannot be built on the personality of its leader, of its physical leader, it can be reinforced by it. The Roman Catholic Church is greatly reinforced by the charismatic personality of their leader. And we are too. So just the same as when Mr. Armstrong and his personality
wanted certain things done in the church, God is able to use Jesus Christ, God is able to use Mr. Descartes, with Jesus Christ working through him, providing the character, to give the church a certain personality. But it's more than just personality. See, Mr. Descartes' job is to build the church on the foundation that God had established through Mr. Armstrong. But his parting words to Mr. Descartes were, your job, your main job, is going to get them all together. I think Mr. Armstrong realized that the worldwide church, now with doctrinal integrity, if it wasn't, it wasn't his fault, nevertheless was not as united as it should be. And Jesus not only said, abide in truth, but become one. And Mr. Armstrong had recognized that he had not completed the task of unifying the church. That's what had to be done next. And Mr. Descartes has followed that lead in his own way to start uniting the church. He's done it in the last way that most of us who knew him would have expected. Because Mr. Descartes was not a traveler. Mr. Descartes grew up in Chicago and was transferred to Pasadena back in 1966 and essentially stayed there all his ministry. He isn't a man, he's a family-oriented man. He doesn't want to go charging off all around the world. And the last thing that I would have expected Mr. Descartes to do in the first 2 years of his life is go to Africa twice, Europe three times, plan a trip to Australia, plan a trip to these other places. And the way he's approached doing the job of unifying the church has been perhaps the most unexpected, but the most spectacularly successful. You've seen two of the films we've made, and I hope you've enjoyed them, and I hope you feel you know Mr. Descartes a little bit better now, to the point where when he comes down here, he's going to seem like a familiar friend. Well, he's not on a personality kick to make himself popular, but he recognizes that the office of apostle does have a unifying effect. He also knows, like Nehemiah did, that before you begin to build, you better find out what you got to build with. Remember when Nehemiah was appointed by the Persians to build Jerusalem? The first thing he did when he hit town was to walk around the walls a few times and not even really tell anybody he was there for 3 days. He wanted to assess the tools and the workforce. Now, I've heard Mr. Descartes say, you've heard him say on tape, what good is a general without an army? I need to know what the troops are like. I need to know how they're doing. I need to know where they live. He often uses the example of General Patton, who, when reviewing the troops, was given a special meal and threw it on the ground and said, I want to eat what the men are eating. I want to know how far they can go. Mr. Descartes wants to see the church. He wants to see where they meet. He wants to see what they're like. He wants to catch the feeling, the ambience of the church. And so he has made travel thousands of miles in the must be dozens of thousands of miles now around the world, not visiting heads of state or world leaders except where they have specifically asked to see him. The only one who specifically asked to see him was King Hussein. What's Mr. Descartes going to say? Ah, oh, no, don't think I will. No, he got up and went. But he hasn't looked to necessarily simply duplicate what Mr. Armstrong did. He said, I think my job is to get to know the people, get to see the people, get to see where they are, see how they are, see if the local ministers are doing their job. And he said, well, you know, I've made a goal. I want to shake hands with every member of the church. And he means it. So when he comes down here, don't be surprised. He'll stand around till you're all tired, shaking hands and talking. I think he's going to love Australia, and I think you're going to love him, because I think he's just the sort of guy who goes over in Australia well. There's no put on, and he's natural. His experience was on the shop floor, not the executive office,
and I think you'll find that he'll be someone you can like, and I think he'll find your people he will like. But the point is that Mr. Rakach has put into us and got us thinking about and speaks about all the time, we are family. To the point where, if you're not careful, we are family could become another two trees. What's he going to talk about? We are family. The danger is of letting apostolic messages become cliches and slogans. So much of John's teachings have become religious cliches. Thy word is truth. God is love. The golden verse. For God so loved the world. And you know, Protestants and all can rally this stuff off. The trouble is that the core, central, vital, important message wrapped in an apostle's personality and teaching can become sloganized. Mr. Armstrong used the expression, a voice cries out. Some lame brains made a t-shirt about it. A voice cries out t-shirts. It wasn't here. We are family is a nice expression. We are one family is a nice expression. We've used it as the title of a bunch of films we're going to be making about Mr. Rakach's trip. I don't care if people want to make up songs about it and put it on a balloon, if that helps. But let it be more than that. You see, don't let it be something that you just, oh yeah, Mr. Rakach is a we are one family apostle, whereas Mr. Armstrong was the two trees apostle, and John was the apostle of love, and Moses was the apostle of Red Seas, and so on. They were important messages that, because they were repeated, had the danger of being sloganized. Deep spiritual concepts are harder to grasp than you might at first think. Deep spiritual concepts are harder to grasp than you might at first think, because they appear to be very simple. Did they ever have those water snake things down here, those orange things which were sort of plastic and you filled them with water and then they sort of were slippery and had no coefficient of friction, you squeeze them and they go boop? Did they ever have them? No, obviously. You haven't the slightest idea what I'm talking about, and it's a very dumb analogy. And I don't have one that fits the Australian scene. Therefore, I will say again, spiritual, deep spiritual concepts are much harder to grasp than you might at first think. They're like a slippery pole. When you actually get to do it, you think, ah, anyone can do that. Then you find it's harder. You can get a deep spiritual concept superficially fairly easily, just the same as people thought they understood Jesus' parables. And certainly there's a superficial level of understanding that a kid in kindergarten can understand. The parable of the prodigal son, the parable of the sower, the parable of the whatever it is. But the more you grow spiritually, the more you realize there's more in that. And that's why I say, all of us, wherever we are in the ministerial food chain, whether you're eating from the feet of the apostles or eating from the feet of the local elders, would do well to think very carefully about what God is now getting across to us through Mr. Rakach's message of We Are One Family, which you're going to hear when he comes down here. You see, a family is a far harder concept to grasp, particularly in a world where Satan has diluted the concept of family, ruined it, and we have single parent families, where we have surrogate mothers. Somebody in South Africa recently had her own grandchildren. And you get weird situations where you sort of see in the King's Cross newspapers things like, we will keep our two-headed baby, say, gay couple, and this sort of nonsense. The concept of family, the concept of a group of people who are welded together by more than simply convenience, is kind of gotten diluted, particularly in the developed world, the industrial society. Families are things of convenience. We have trial marriages, we have living together, we have all of this. And the idea of a family of parents who have a duty and a responsibility to children, who have a duty and a responsibility to parents, who are joined forever
with a responsibility to each other has become very, very diluted. You know, we've often used the words a team. We've got to become a big team. Mr. Descartes used to use that. Haven't heard him use it so much since he's become the apostle. You see, a team is dangerous. A team is what the world puts together in order to get things done, isn't it? We have a business team. You have, I hope, unless things have really gone to pot, an Australian cricket team. In fact, from the papers I see that they're doing fairly well in Bombay and probably will end up beating England, which is a shame. But the problem, what happens on a team when someone isn't making it? What happens on a team when someone slows down, gets old, gets sick, gets an emotional problem or something? You drop them from the team. What happens in a business when a team of executives suddenly don't produce the results anymore? They are dropped from the team. Teams are all right as long as you are succeeding. Teams are a group of people who get together to succeed. I don't know anybody who forms a team to lose. Let's get the worst possible group of people and go out there and lose better than anyone before. They don't do that. So a team is only a part of what should be formed when a group of people get together to accomplish something very, very very, very important. What Jesus Christ is doing with us while we're doing the work is building in us a group of people who he can use as begotten sons of God and younger brothers and sisters of Jesus Christ to bring the rest of the human race, whether they are Australians or New Zealanders or Americans or South Africans or Eskimos or what do you call them now? Kuris, right? Not called Aborigines anymore, Kuris. Well, in some ways that's nicer. But whatever they are, to eventually to the same level. Jesus Christ's attitude simply was, as expressed in Philippians 2, I want other people to have what I want. I am not happy just being God. I would like other people to have what I want, whoever they are. I'm not willing that any should perish, that all should come to repentance. No matter what color, no matter what shape, no matter what age, no matter what handicaps, there's a plan that's being worked out that eventually brings everyone together into a family. And God didn't talk about a team, he talked about a family relationship. I think Mr. Armstrong realized before he died that the church was not yet that way. There was too much competition, too much individuality, too much personal ambition. And if we're not careful, doing the work can be a way for us to realize our own personal ambitions, whether employed or not employed, rather than a means by which we can grow to become a family that can then later on be trusted with a far more important task. And that is bringing them in, helping them, helping them to become part of the family too. You know, the only people who can add you to a family are members of that family. Ever thought about that? You can't be added to a family by outside. You can't be added to a family artificially, not in the truest sense of the word. So Christ has to have a family working with him before he starts to add the other members of the human race. And we've got to be more than a team. You can't go dumping people. He said, you know, in John 13:34, we should turn to at least one scripture in this sermon, just to prove I've got a Bible. John 13:34. Yeah, here we go. A new commandment I give unto you. Oh, great. New one. What is it? Keep birthdays. That you love one another.
Boring.
As I have loved you. That's new. that you love one another as I have loved you is new. Hadn't said that quite that way before. And I suppose, dutifully, the apostles went, aha, right, right, okay, new commandment, love one another as I have loved you, thank, what next? Because they didn't fully understand the extent and the depth to which he loved them. That his wasn't just a matter of convenience, he wasn't assembling a team, that he was playing with them for keeps, that this wasn't a team he was going to dump people off. Judas was determined to jump ship, but the rest of them he intended to persist with, that he wasn't going to dump them, he wasn't going to forget about them, he wasn't going to leave them. I will never leave you or forsake you, he said. I intend to persist with the people I've called through thick and thin, and bring them to the point where they are with me forever. He said that. I will that you be with me, if it's possible. Then he said, by this will all men know that you are my disciples, if you have love one to another. In other words, your success in making the message known depends very much to the extent to which we can become a family, loving one another as God loved us. And there's a lot more in there than superficially meets the eye, because it's a lot harder to love people as Christ loved us than we might at first think. But he said, if you do this, you'll be successful in letting all men know who I am. Otherwise, I'm not going to prosper it. You see, today, you can let all men know something. Really, with the means of mass media, mass communication, advertising, the other means we have, it's fairly easy, even if you don't love one another, to let all men know something. The advertising world is the most ruthless, the most cutthroat, the most heartless. If a product fails, the advertising agency gets dumped, or the executive of the count executive gets dumped. Nevertheless, using today's business team methods, you can get all people to know something. I'll tell you something, all men know. Things go better with Coke. Right? It used to be in Australia that all men knew any owl have a Winfield. I don't know whether we still have that. To the point where all you had to have was a picture of Paul Hogan and a little asterisk kind of a deal, and people thought Winfield. Supremely effective. We've got to do better than that. We've got to let people know something far more important. It's possible, with the team method, to be successful in preaching some sort of a message. That's why Mr. Dukács is saying, be careful not to let the doing of the work get in the way of building the right relationships with one another. Don't let doing the work become a vehicle by which we can use the same methods as the world uses in getting things done. Because this world's a ruthless place. It knows no other way. It's built on the wrong foundation. We've got another foundation to be built on. Mr. Dukács is now concerned that the first commission be built legitimately on the foundation that he was left with. And his focus is on, you notice, not so much getting the work done, which is very much a focus for him, but his focus has been in these first few years on become a family. And he's focused on that more than Mr. Armstrong ever did. Mr. Dukács has tried to avoid the waste, tried to pull in some of the funds that were going on some things that he sees now. No, I want to do this first. A lot of money that was going to other projects has been pulled in to help the church. Mr. Armstrong warned him. He said, Mr. Dukács, I want you to look at this AICF. Maybe it's gotten too big in some ways. Think about it. Make sure. It's a good idea, but it can get out of hand. Bring it back. These are the things you have to concentrate on. In other words, it seems
that the old apostle, in passing on the baton, gave his successor some advice on what God wanted to do next. And our job is to follow that lead. Our job is to try and understand, not just make it a slogan, not let "We Are One Family" become the latest catchphrase whereby you are loyal if you keep muttering it, but to think about it and to say, in what way am I not? Now, certainly activities, themes, balloons, if you want, can reinforce it. But the real understanding of "We Are One Family" has got to go on in the individual hearts of people, changing the way they think about each other, changing the relationships they have with one another, changing the way we think. See, just the same as Mr. Armstrong told me, you don't understand those two trees because it hasn't altered the way you think. It was like hitting me across the bridge of the nose with a wet fish. We Are One Family should change the way we as individuals think about things. To start thinking about relationships from the point of view of how do they stack up with "Love one another as I have loved you." Because it would seem that this has got to be done. Next. How long is next? I don't know. It's shorter than a very. I do know that. Because Mr. Descartes has said that we'd better become a family. Otherwise, when we do what has to be done after the next, but during the very, before the second coming, we're not going to hold together. See, that's why the Apostle John was so concerned about the aspect of love. Because he knew the church was going to go through some things where if they didn't love one another, it would fall apart, which is what Satan would want. Mr. Descartes is concerned that the family relationship is there and built. I'll finish with a story that doesn't necessarily do me much credit, but I think it illustrates the point of the difference in the way we're thinking. Because so often we can, in the church, even become competitive among ourselves, competitive with other churches, or at least, you know, this is somewhere we go on the Sabbath and so on, without building that sense of family, of bond, of his welfare really matters to me. Her welfare really matters to me. I am concerned that she is unhappy, that he is worried, that she is frustrated. Just the same as you are in your own family. But then, as Mr. Descartes has again told us, maybe we have to reinforce those boundaries in our own family. Maybe our own family is not providing a good model for us to learn to love others. Because in this perverted world, even families don't have this natural effectiveness. A husband and wife team. They're not a team. Well, yeah, in a sense, because you drop one when the other one doesn't perform. Can't do that. Some years ago, before I ever came up here in Melbourne, when I was a local elder, young, knowing everything. It's funny, you start out knowing everything, it sort of dwindles as the years go by. But in those days, I knew several things. First of all, I knew that in every way I knew more than everybody else because I was a minister. That was evident, because no one ever disagreed with me. They better not have done. The other thing I knew was that the most important thing in the world was to come to Springvale Town Hall every Sabbath, because Christ was coming soon. And anything that would get in the way of that meant that this person wasn't being called and therefore would be going into the lake of fire, or at least the tribulation. And armed with that knowledge and the Ford Fairmont, I would sally forth from my home in Glen Waverley to do battle with a hostile world. One day we got a letter from the office in Sydney asking us to visit this person down in near Springvale. So Mr. Fay gave me the envelope, the letter, And off I went, fisherman for Christ, with my harpoon. We went to this person's home, and it was a lady in a beat-up old place, you know, the screen door hanging off, gardens full of natural foliage, let's put it that way. Weatherboard, real junk heap. She came to the door. The place stank like, you know, several dogs had died in the basement. And snaggletoothed old bag came to the door. House dress, apron, hair last combed in 1949. And she brought us into the house, and we sat on this sagging couch. Dust flew in the air, fleas and everything else. And I sort of said, well, what can we do for you? She said, I want to know more about your church. I said, oh, great. She says, what do you want to know about our church? I didn't hit her with third tithe right away and Day of Atonement, fortunately. And she was talking, and as she was talking, suddenly this noise came from the other room, like, she said, excuse me, and went in. Be one of those days, I said to the assistant. She came back, and she began to ask some quite reasonable questions. I was just about getting rid of a brilliantly scintillating answer that would cut her down and do away with her vain imaginations, and she excused me and went out again. And she came back, and she asked some more reasonable questions. Anyway, we put an end to that visit, tried to find a reason to drop her, because that's what we used to do in those days. And she wrote again and asked for, was called again and said, I'd like you to come again. So we came again. It was a repeat performance. She'd go out again. We'd come in, ask questions. We'd try and explain the Bible and so on. But after about three visits, I began to realize the woman did have an unusual understanding. So I said to her, you really should start keeping the Sabbath. She said, I do. Isn't it from Friday sunset to Saturday sunset? I said, yes. She said, oh, I've been keeping that for a long time. And I send you a tenth of what we can. So, well, then you should start attending our church. And her face fell. She said, oh, I don't know if I can. And I said, well, you've got to. She said, well, where is it? I said, it's just across there in Springvale Town Hall. She said, oh, maybe I could get away. What do you mean, get away? People come, hack through the jungle, canoes, you know, in Africa, and just to come and listen. I mean, what do you mean, get away? She said, yeah, I think I could perhaps come. Is it every week? I said, yes. God's church meets every week, not like these worldly churches. Well, I don't know if I could come every week. She said, is there anything else I'd have to go to? So I thought, boy, lady, teach you to be Laodicean before you're even Philadelphian. Said, yes, there is. We have holy days. She said, oh, you mean the ones in the booklet, like the Feast of Trumpets and the Day of Atonement? I said, yeah. She said, are they like the Sabbaths? I said, well, yeah. I said, we have two services. She said, oh, well, maybe I could come to one of them. And she said, anything else? I said, yeah, gotcha. Feast of Tabernacles. She said, what's that? I said, well, we go away for 8 days. Where? Blue Mountains, New South Wales, Blackheath, where God has placed his name. I know he's placed it all over the place now, but then it was Blackheath. One place. She says, oh, I don't think I could come then. I said, well, you mean you're not going to keep God's feast days? Said I tactfully. She said, well, do I have to? Yes, you do. I mean, you're going to have to figure out a pretty good reason, lady, otherwise. I mean, talking to a local elder here. 4 years of Ambassador College, know the truth. She said, well, then I think we'll have to forget it. Now, all the time, there was this going on in the back room. And I said, why? She said, well, you see, my sons. What about your sons? She said, well, that noise you hear are my sons. I've got two boys. They're about 17 and 18. But unfortunately, they were born without proper brains. And so they've never grown up. And really what they are sort of like vegetables or like babies lying in a crib, and they've never been able to do anything for themselves. And they can't look after themselves, and they're incontinent, they have to be fed, and they make a mess, and so on. And so my husband and I really try to look after them. She said, we've been told we should put them in a home, but we can't do that. We brought them into the world. They're the only parents we have. We're the only parents they have. We know that if we put them in a home, they'd be taken care of, but they wouldn't be loved. And so I felt that really we should, you know, devote our lives to trying to doing the best we can for them. And I felt about that high, because I'd been a brash young idiot, and looking back on it, this lady had set a finer example of love and care and family than I'd ever seen. And she said, I don't think I could be a full participating member of your church, because that's my family and we never go anywhere without them. Well, at the time, and perhaps it was the right thing in retrospect, we dropped her. I don't know what's become of her since. I'm fairly certain she didn't come into the church. Maybe God wasn't fully and completely calling her. I hope I wasn't a roadblock. And perhaps she's still reading the plain truth, I don't know. But looking back on it, that lady taught me something about family, that being a team never could. That we're never going anywhere without them. There's got to be the way we feel about each other. And the reason is not because the members of God's church today are handicapped, feeble-minded, helpless, slobbering, incontinent vegetables. We're just not. But out there beyond the millennium, when the very soon has become now and the millennium started, and then the millennium's over, and there's the period of great white throne judgment after that, there's a lot of very unattractive people are going to need to be brought into the family. There's a lot of people with difficulties, a lot of people who may not be physical cripples but are emotional cripples. And in those days, we aren't going to be able to get them in another resurrection. You see? In those days, we can't simply postpone it the way Jesus Christ can now. Now, he can fish. And if he doesn't like the look of what he drags up in the net, he can throw it back. And it'll live again. But in those days, when prophecy is coming to its end, and it's do or die, what we catch, we're going to have to work with. And it's going to need a lot of love, a lot of tolerance, a lot of patience. But the plan of God is that everybody has what we have. Jesus Christ died not just for us, but for everybody. And ultimately, this group of people have got to work together to train more people so that when the time comes, God will have a family that he can add all those that Satan has bent up and twisted and messed up, and begin to deal with them and want for them what we have for ourselves, eternal life. If we approach that task the way the world has taught us to work together, there's going to be a lot of people eventually not saved. So therefore, I think it's kind of significant that what God is leading the new apostle to teach us now is not a slogan, it's not a cute little saying, but it's one of the most fundamentally important things that you and I need to understand. That we're not a team, we're not a church, that we're not a group of people who are just together for social activities or because we know about the Sabbath, but we've got to learn to become a family who learns to feel about each other the way Jesus Christ felt about us, so that eventually we will feel about the rest of the human race the way Jesus Christ feels about them. Since I left Australia, I've traveled a lot. I've had the opportunity to visit over 75 different countries. And there's some awfully difficult people that are going to have to be roped in one day. Not the sort of people that you and I would like to know. But the message of the Bible is that we're not going anywhere without them. And we're going to have to learn to work together so one day we can help them. It's not just a coincidence, perhaps, that Mr. Dukach is beginning his administration by trying to reinforce and teach us what Mr. Armstrong passed on to them. Get them unified. Get them working together. And I think you'll find that's what he's going to tell you when he comes down in just a few weeks. It's been great being back. Look forward to meeting you afterwards.